Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Joseph Brinton, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and by Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in over 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, week-long experiences in Washington, D.C., the nation's only campaign management minor, and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Helping Those in Need, and today's guest is Kristen Cox. Kristen Cox was appointed by Governor Huntsman as the Executive Director of Workforce Services in March of 2007. In this capacity, Kristen oversaw the operations of 12 divisions encompassing federal and state programs, including workforce development, public assistance programs, and unemployment insurance. Prior to this appointment, Kristen held positions in Maryland as Secretary of the nation's first cabinet-level Department of Disabilities and as the Director of the Governor's Office for Individuals with Disabilities. Kristen now serves as the Executive Director of the Governor's Office of Management and Budget. Kristen graduated from Brigham Young University with a Bachelor of Science in Educational Psychology and has been awarded numerous honors as well as serving on many boards and commissions. Kristen and her husband Randy have two sons. So please join with me in welcoming our guest, Kristen Cox.
So I'm not sure how to, is this on?
Yeah.
Am I on?
Okay.
So it's fun to be here again, and I hope what I have to say is relevant. I love the term practical politics. Sometimes I think that's lacking, a real practical application of public policy and what we're trying to accomplish. Dr. Chambliss asked me to kind of do a bit of a repeat of what I did last time. I guess it's been maybe 6 months or a year, and with some changes and modifications. Because in politics, as in life, we grow and learn and change and get new insights and how things should actually work. But I am a very practical person. It's so funny because you guys saw that my original training years and years ago was in educational psychology special ed. I taught for a little bit. And my husband just laughs. He's like, "You are so not qualified to do what you're doing now with your training." I said, "Come on, I learned along the way." So I thought I'd go through the process that we use to really address difficult challenges in government. Anything from people who need assistance, low-income individuals, to actual tax policy reform and setting up budgets. And this new role in the Governor's Office of Management and Budget, my responsibility, the governor, obviously, it's his budget, but is to help work with our budget people to put the budget together and our budget officer, what should be funded, what shouldn't be funded, and then over the operations for the state, all the different agencies, what do we expect from them, how should they operate, what are the deliverables. So we actually have a pretty structured process we go through, and I'll walk you through that process today. It's a roadmap we like to use so that we can really accelerate substantial improvement in government and public policy. So we'll start through now. Here's the thing you guys have to do today with me. If I'm speaking to a PowerPoint that doesn't exist because I'm blind, you need to tell me that because that won't work well. So speak out because I'm going to do a dry run on this. So title page, Lori, are you clicking this?
Uh-huh.
Title page. We'll go to the agenda. There's four things I want to cover today, which is the goal for Utah. A little bit of a case study, quick results on our case study. And then go through the what we call the success framework, what is the real roadmap to bring policy to actual fruition through operations. And we'll cruise through that. Our goal in Utah really is to be the best managed state by any measurable standard, which is that for every dollar invested, we get more and more value, that you can actually measure it. If a taxpayer puts a dollar into the system, they get more value either through cost, quality, or what we call throughput, which is system capacity. How much can the system actually produce? Often in government, we look at outputs, and maybe we look at specific outcomes, but we seldom look at these three things, cost, quality, and throughput in conjunction. And we'll talk about measurement systems here in a little bit. So that's our real goal in Utah. We think it's important to have ambitious goals. When you set goals and targets, Sometimes we do it within the white noise. There's always variation in any system that you look at. You can have 5, 10% variation, and we call that white noise. It's easy for anyone to go into a public policy arena and say, I'm going to improve by 2, 4%. That just happens by itself. When we talk improvements, we're talking substantial gains, 25%, 30%, sometimes 40% improvement in your systems. So we want to be outside the white noise, and that's our real goal for Utah. It's very big, ambitious goals. When we look at this being the best managed state, how do we accomplish that? There's 5 important questions we think we should answer, and our success framework helps us do that. The first thing is, why change? That sounds easy. There's not always a lot of clarity, and when people want to make changes, having clarity about why we want to change, what we want to change, what we want to change it to, how we're going to implement the change, and then how do we know if the change was successful? Very often in the public policy world, people will hit 1 or 2 of those questions. Very often, they'll skip the what, why change, and they'll start going right to the tactics of changing. Let's talk health care reform, for example. There's a move right to move to a health care exchange. Understanding that's a very good tactic or strategy when you start talking about what you're going to change or what you're going to change it to, but sometimes we're weak in the how-to or the why or the final piece of how do you measure if the change was successful. So our success framework is designed to help us answer those 5 questions. And I think a very rigorous and sequential way. And we believe that there's dependencies in public policy that you have to answer one question before you move to the next and to be rigorous around that discussion. Next slide is our, don't tell me, Lori, because this is the first time I'm going through this, our focus. So let's talk about this really quick. When we talk about changes in government, we are looking at studies, about 12 of them, and we found that even from 50 to 100%, if the improvements, not just in government, these are private sector too, if the changes initiated, strategies, planning, initiatives, blah, 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 50 to 100%, so average of 70 about, failed. Isn't that interesting? 50 to 100%, let's say 70% of projects, strategies, initiatives failed to really bring the substantial gains that they promised. We're talking outside the white noise. They failed. So why does that happen? There's a lot of reasons why that happens. Hopefully, we'll talk about some of the, have time in the Q&A section, but to give you a quick overview, why does government, for example, want to launch a big initiative? How many times do you hear about big initiatives in government? It drives me crazy. Most of them fail to bring substantial improvements. One, they'll look at what we call, I'm going to give you the words and we'll walk through it a little bit later, local optimization versus system improvement. So you take a big system, and you want out of the system to have a big improvement, and they'll focus on one piece of it getting fixed. It's like having a football team, and you want to make a touchdown, and they're so excited because the linebacker is making more and more tackles, and they think that's the success, but the team keeps losing and not making touchdowns. This team didn't win. The linebacker may be making more touchdowns, the running back may be getting more yards, but if the team as a whole doesn't make more touchdowns, they've lost. So we do a lot of local optimization versus system throughput, which is one of our big problems. The other big problem that we'll talk about is lack of focus. We'll talk about root cause analysis. If you have a lot of things to focus on, especially in government, there's a million things you could do. There's a million needs, a million issues, a million policies. Which one do you focus on? Because if you only have limited time or resources, if you put your money and your time on the wrong thing, it's not just that you're focusing on the wrong thing that's the problem. It's the opportunity cost of what you're not focusing on. And how do you decide that? How do you know what you focus on? So some of that lack of focus and local optimization versus system improvement were some real big drivers of why these systems just weren't getting the substantial gains they hoped for. So hopefully our system that we take, that we use, that we've kind of developed, sometimes through failure, knowing what we didn't do right and trying to fix it, addresses some of those reasons why policies seem to not always work out the way people intended. Let me give you just a quick case study of what we did and then how we're applying it to other agencies. Anyone remember the Great Recession? You guys are all so young, huh? You're like living at home still, maybe. Great Recession, so perfect storm. We call it the perfect storm slide. Workforce services, we served, keep thinking that I run it. I don't anymore. We served individuals, low-income individuals, unemployment insurance, food stamps, Medicaid, CHIP, which is Children's Health Insurance Program, refugee services, general assistance, which typically helps homeless individuals. What do you think happened when the recession started to hit to our caseloads at Workforce Services? Yeah, they just went out of control. At the same time, we were implementing the biggest IT system in the state of Utah at the time. It was an $80 million IT project, which was a completely new system of how our workers were going to interface with it. We had a lot of new policy changes, EUC, which was, if you've heard of it, unemployment insurance, extending unemployment insurance. It was the perfect storm. And we knew that the budget and the revenue in the states, as we were projecting out, what were going to happen to the revenue in the state coming in, up or down? Down, right? So we're going up our caseloads. We're projecting revenues to go down, which means our budget's going to go down. And we have this new IT system. What are we going to do? How are we going to handle this? So we started to apply what we call this success framework. Cody, can you go to the hair on fire slide, Lori? We call this the hair on fire slide because our workers felt like this. It was a stressful time. Our caseloads are going up, and more money was coming in, and they were stressed out. So that was the other big driver. It's not just dealing with our customers. It's helping our employees actually have a work environment where they can be, you know, successful and achieve what they need to achieve. It's a very difficult time. Now, one of our driving principles for me was this idea of live within your means. I know it seems totally counterintuitive in government, but we believed it. So we started this process with the belief that we didn't want to ask for more money. Even though we could have gone to the legislature and made a case, we didn't want to for a number of reasons. One, we thought that as a responsible agency, we had to figure out a way with no more money coming in just to figure it out. And that if we asked for money, we'd be taking money for people who needed heart transplants and Medicaid, or senior citizens in long-term care and nursing facilities. We understood the opportunity cost for every dollar we got. It was a dollar not going to somebody in a need. So we wanted to see if we could figure this out and just absorb these costs. And it was a big challenge. But one of the things we'll talk about when we talk about setting goals and targets is ambitious goals. If we think, we've always heard the Henry Ford thing, if you think you can and you can't, you're right. We wanted to go with this assumption that would drive our philosophy and our approach and our policies and our decisions, that we are going to have better quality than we've ever had in our system, and we are going to do it for less cost. And we're going to do it all with trying to make the work environment, the hair on fire, go away for our staff. So the results, Lori, is this the cool chart?
Mm-hmm.
You call this the cool chart. At the end of the day, we reduced our cost by 33%. So we had a cost per unit case we'll talk about in a second. It was $57.66 cost per case. We got it down. Our goal is $35.10. It's now at about $36.37 per case. So it was about a 33% decrease in our costs. Our quality went from, there's lots of different ways that they were measuring quality, but it went from 90 to 95%. In some of the audits, it went from 70 to 95%. So huge improvement. And the federal standard for turning things around was 30 days. We're average 12 to 14. So we really achieved the goals. And you can see this graph shows our caseloads going up, our FTEs going down, and our budget going down, which is where we wanted to see it. And we didn't bring the quality chart, but that overlays on that. So real improvements. Now I'm going to walk you through how do you actually get that done. Because at the end of the day, public policy, it's about getting stuff done, making a difference for people and their lives and the taxpayers and those receiving services. That's all it is. It's taking an idea and operationalizing it in a way. At the end of the day, you get a result. So that's kind of the little case study. So let's walk through how we actually did that. Is this the success thing, Lori?
Yep.
Okay, so I used to call this in my head, and it was ridiculous, CIOBPPP, which in my head, I live in acronyms in my world. And so that was just, in my mind, if you're going to run an organization, you had to look at a lot of different elements, everything from infrastructure, organizational design, business processes, policies, performance measures, personnel issues, all these things. What we did is we turned it into something that makes sense. And success is just simply a way to remember all the elements we need to pay attention to in sequence. So I'm going to go through each one of these, and let me just do a big high picture for you, and then we'll go through each element. But S, the first S is for set targets and goals. U is use thinking tools. C is create your strategy. Next, C, create your organization. Then E, engage staff. Then the final S, stay focused. Those things seem really clear, very obvious. But they seldom happen in government consistently and in sequence. So we'll walk through each one of these. And honestly, with each one of these, we could probably spend about 2 hours just lecturing on each one of these elements. But I'll give you a high-level exposure to it. Let's start with this idea of set your goal and set your target. Doesn't that seem easy? Wouldn't you think that people just understood what their goals were for a system? First, you have your goal and your target. You just assume that, right? Not the case. When we started this process in eligibility services, that case study I just showed you, there was no clear goal. What was this system all about? And that's really where the public policy piece comes in. What are we trying to accomplish? When you looked at the system, it looked like people were trying to process what we call tasks. The system would alert them they need to change an address or get a new billing code or get verification for a bank account or make a decision on household composition. They were getting tasks. And the measure of the system was if you were caught up on your tasks and if you were processing your task and not late. Do you think that should be the goal of a system? What do you think? Until you really ask yourself the question, our people were totally operating and our system was operating as if that were the goal. That is not the goal of the system. The goal was to produce a quality determination in a timely manner. So we defined it right program, right benefit to the right person in a timely manner. That's the goal. So we had to shift the system from making tasks to making a determination to decide if somebody is eligible for Medicaid, eligible for food stamps or not. That is the goal of the system. When you set that goal, it starts to set up this whole domino effect on how you're going to operate, what you're going to pay attention to, what's important or what's not. Here's what it also does. There's a great analogy. We worked with a guy named Kevin Fox, and he told us this analogy, and I loved it. It's for the private sector, but I think it's so relevant in government as well. He walked into a shop at one point, and the shop made cars. And he was watching the welder, and the welder had a weld. And the way you know if a welder's doing his job or not, or her job, is you see a lot of blue light, right? Apparently that thing they use makes a lot of blue light. So if you're watching the welder and they don't have a lot of blue light going on, you know that he or she is not using his time at the max. So he's observing this system, and the welder would be in kind of using welding, and then he'd walk over and he'd get a bumper and he'd bring the bumper over and weld a little bit more. Then he'd carry the bumper over to another side and take the plastic off. And most of his time was all of this back and forth stuff, not blue lighting. The goal of that welder was not just to move stuff around. The goal of that welder was to blue light, to have as much blue light going on as possible. That's what he was trained to do. That was his most important competency. So when we think the goal of a system, we really have to ask ourselves at the big level and at each different piece along the way when we talk about throughput is what is the blue light? What are we really trying to accomplish? For eligibility, it was that. Unemployment insurance. The system as a whole for decades in unemployment insurance for the country has operated off the need for unemployment insurance is to cut somebody a check, to get the check out to them as quickly as possible. Now, that's important because it stabilizes the economy, and that's one of the purposes of unemployment insurance. But that's a piece of it. What do you guys think the real goal of unemployment insurance should be? To get them back to work, exactly. The goal should be to stabilize their income so that we can get them back to work. Understanding and clarifying that goal is not something that Congress or the United States government has done for years. There's been states that have individually taken that on. And because our goal is set in the right way, the time people are in unemployment insurance, Utah, Texas, some other states who focus on that, our duration rate are some of the lowest in the country because we get people on. Our goal is to help them stabilize and get them back to work. Setting your goal is critical in systems design because it will impact everything else we do. So that's the first thing. Be clear on what your goal is. The next piece is setting targets. That's great if you say your goal of unemployment insurance is to reduce your duration rate by 10%, you know, to reduce your goal of unemployment rate of unemployment is to get people back to work. But unless you have a target and you're clear on what I'm trying to get done this year, people still just stay unfocused. They have a great goal, it sounds aspirational, people feel good about it, blah, 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 but nothing gets done. So what we want to do is then set ambitious targets. With unemployment insurance, we want to have the lowest duration rate in the country, and this year we're going to reduce it by 10% and reduce our cost per case by 15%. Let's have clarity on what we're trying to achieve. I think people hide behind confusion and a lot of processes because that's easier than to actually make a decision about what you're trying to do. Because when you make the decision, you're committed, and it limits your choices. And it's sometimes easier to live in a world where everything's possible. So we have to make decisions, and that means we're going to say yes to a few things and no to sometimes a lot of others. But we have to have clarity, because when you set up your targets for the year as we move through this, it'll impact how you compensate your staff, what their performance plans look like, what kind of resources and IT projects you approve. It'll drive everything of your decisions when you start making those really clear target-setting things. Now, let me ask this. There's a guy named Dr. Eldie Goldratt. I'll talk to him about him in a little bit. He was just a brilliant man. He was a physicist by training. He became a business process improvement engineer later on in his life. Unfortunately, he just died about 2 years ago. But he was consulting with a company. The company's goal was to increase revenue by $1 billion. And they weren't achieving that. They were only halfway to their mark. And they came to him and they said, well, what do we do? We're not achieving our goal. What should we do? Now, in most cases, if somebody came to you and said, I need to make a billion, I'm only at half a billion, people would give him a lot of advice. Well, cut your costs or try to sell more or reduce your target. Maybe your target's too high. You're not being realistic. You're setting yourself up for failure. What do you think he told him? What's totally counterintuitive about that? He said, double your goal. Go to 2 billion. Isn't that crazy? Most people say, you're crazy. You're setting us up for failure. We can't do 2 billion. Interestingly enough, if I had two sets of managers, you guys here, and I said to you guys, I want to increase our productivity by 400% while improving quality, and I told you guys we're only going to improve our throughput by 2%, and our quality we're just going to leave it the same. What kind of discussions? Do you think the discussions would be different? Fundamentally different, right? If this group over here had to think bold and big, and you may not achieve it, and you may not hit the full goal, but what you think about and how you approach the problem will be very different than these people who play it safe. When we set goals and targets, we often like to set them in our white noise zone, what we're comfortable with and what we're confident we're going to achieve. Who cares what we think we're going to achieve, what we're interested in, what's possible that we don't even know about? For us to even start thinking about what's not on our radar screen, we have to go beyond what our comfort zone is. And when we do that, we'll start to find and discover things that we never knew were possible. We may not hit it. Who cares? We'll get better than we would have in our white noise. One thing I've learned about being blind is first, use good canes. I broke my cane this weekend. I'm using my Yucky cane right now. But two, it's not if something can be done, but it's how. And that's always how we want to start it. Because as a blind person, you have to live very creatively sometimes and do things very different in your life. And you have to start with the assumption that it's not if this is going to happen, but it's how. And that same thing is so true for public policy and in systems design and government. We can do amazing big things if we start with that assumption, with clarity in our targets on those three things. Final conversation around this. Throughput, cost, quality. Throughput is really the system capacity, what we can produce, the thing that's valuable for unemployment insurance, the customer. It's helping them get back to work and cutting them at, giving them income to stabilize. That alone, sometimes in government, we'll just measure that. We'll just say, look at duration rate or how quickly we got the check out or how quickly we got somebody, on Medicaid benefits. And that's an important piece of it. But that only exists within the context of cost. So we want to look at how well we do that throughput or that value proposition we're offering divided by what we call OE, operational cost, and I, infrastructure. Basically, the cost it is for us to deliver that service. Breaking that down into what we call unit cost, so it's very tangible. It cost me $57 to actually do that transaction, or it actually cost me $487 per month to support somebody on Medicaid. Unless we can start baselining that with a lot of clarity, we can't tell if all of our initiatives are improving the system or making it worse. And so we can have a lot of activity and feel good and we're busy, and we don't know if we're moving the needle. But we need to look at it both in the throughput, which is system capacity and the value we offer, divided by our costs. And, of course, the quality is critical. So we look at throughput, cost, quality in all of our measures. Final piece on this we call translation targets. If I'm a person in a system, an employee in unemployment insurance or Medicaid or transportation or public safety, if my system has all these goals, what does that mean for me? What am I accountable for now in my world? We call those translation targets, taking the big targets of an organization, translating them in a way that makes sense for the people actually doing the work. All of this, guys, is not easy. It's a little messy. It takes thought, but it's the only way you can start moving down your system in a way that gets you to where you want to go. So you at least know where you're trying to go, right? That's the first part of success is S. The next one is use thinking tools, and I love this. I wish we had 4 hours on this stuff today. What we want to think about when we do is, before we launch initiatives and strategies, we want to think. We've got brains, we've got capacity, let's use them. But let's use our thinking very strategically on knowing what to focus on and when to focus on it. So let's go to this next slide, root cause analysis. So up there should be a whole bunch of little boxes or something, right? Okay. So when we are in eligibility, for example, there's like 20 different things we could have focused on. Getting our imaging system right. People would send us information, we'd image it, we'd put it on the screen. Our telephone system. People came and said, oh, we need to upgrade our telephone system. That will happen. Help us. That's $1.5 million. Let's get a new phone system. Let's get a text messaging system. Let's get our tasks lined up. Let's get, I don't know, there's our e-rep system up and board. There's a million things you could focus on. So what do you focus on? And does it matter? So let's go to the next slide, Lori. When we line this all up, and this is not a formal thing, but we do something called a current reality tree, which helps you understand your root cause. You put up all your stuff you don't like. We call them UDIs, undesirable effects. Remember, in life and in science, there's always a cause and effect relationship. Always. There's always dependencies. What's important is to figure out all of the, as well as you can, how everything relates. What effects are, and what do those effects cause, and what are the effects of that cause? When you line them all up, this isn't a perfect what we call current reality tree, and there's a whole rigorous process to do this, but you line these all up, and you can find at the end of the tree, there's something here at the bottom, it says tasks, right, Lori?
Mm-hmm.
Determinations.
Mm-hmm.
If we could switch our focus from tasks to determinations, then that would impact our policies and what we'd image and our e-rep system and everything else that was undesirable, the things we didn't like. If we could fix that thing, that one thing to focus on would start to have an impact on all the other negative things we didn't like. So rather than just having the scattered approach and trying to fix everything and do a little bit of everything, we really focused our energy and our time and our resources on this idea of tasks and determinations. Doesn't that sound simple? Like one little thing can make an impact, but it can. And I'll show you in a second why that's the case. So you want to start with some root cause. Now, go to the next slide, Lori, which is the ABCDE. Is that up?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in a system, and this looks really simple, okay? This isn't always this simple. I wish it were. But if you're in a system, ABCD, does that have ABCDE? It has five things. And each part of your system has a different capacity to produce something. And this is true if you're in a true production line, where you're just trying to get a benefit out the door, or if you're in a more service delivery environment and you're helping kids on in foster care. Every part of your system has different kinds of capacity to produce, to do its job. In this system, what's the weakest link? What's the piece that has the least ability to produce? C, right? Uh-huh. So if I were to put a lot of my time and effort in trying to fix B, would my system as a whole be able to produce more? It doesn't, right? It can only produce as much as C can produce. If I put a lot of my time and my energy on E, and I got it 400 times more productive and effective, would my system have any more capacity? No, it wouldn't, right? Because something comes in, we can only get 10 out. Is C 10? Yeah. We can only get 10 pieces out of this system. That's all we can do. We're only as good as C. We're only as good as our weakest link. And any system has it. So you could have a chain of 1,000 links, but there's always a weakest link. The challenge in your system is to find your weakest link. Now, weakest link sounds bad and stuff, right? Nobody wants to be a weakest link. We actually have another term for it. It's called a control point. Your control point is essentially your bottleneck, your constraint, the thing that if you don't pay attention to, if you don't get more of, you're not going to be able to move your system forward. Now, if you're in a production line, again, just producing an eligibility check or a payment or provider information, that's pretty easy to find. If you're in an environment, again, like child welfare, it's a little harder, but there are elements to find a constraint. It's typically the resource you want more and more of. It's the skill that's hardest to get. If you go to a doctor's office, the constraint's the doctor. It's the hardest resource to get. It's the most expensive resource. And you want more and more of it. You want more and more good diagnoses from a doctor, right? So you can go to any service environment and find your constraint. Lori, can you go to the next slide? Does that kind of make sense? So what does government tend to do? What do you think it tends to do in that A, B, C, D environment? Doesn't even know its constraint and starts fixing everything at the same time. And you start fixing everything at the same time, and you've spent millions of dollars, and you may see marginal improvement. What a waste of time and energy, right? You see marginal improvement. Focus is one of the most important pieces in taking an idea and operationalizing it, knowing what to focus on, when, and how much. So that's really important. So there's 5 steps to do this. Once you find your constraint, first you identify your constraint. Not always easy. And again, there's different ways. You can ask yourself, what's your blue light? What's the resource I need more and more of? What's the hardest thing to find? What is, in fact, through capacity, the weakest link? And when you practice this enough, you start to get a sense of where constraints are. And there's actually, in organizations, different shapes. And I don't even want to get into that because it'll bore you to death. But different shapes tend to push different constraints in the organization, depending on what the shape of the organization is. But you identify your constraint. And it says you do everything you can to, they use the word exploit, but that seemed like kind of bad. So we say to squeeze everything out of it. Squeeze everything you can out of it. If you're in that first slide C, and C was only producing 10, remember the example of the welder, the blue light? If you could take all that stuff away from him that he was doing that wasn't critical and offload that to a cheaper resource, eliminate it. We do 3 things. We do eliminate, offload, lean. Eliminate it if they don't need to do it. And I'll show you something here in a little bit of how you can approach that. Eliminate the task. It's wasteful. Don't do it. If it's something that still needs to happen but can go to a resource that has capacity, you can take C's work and send it to B because B's got capacity, or to a cheaper resource, offload it. And if it's something that C has to do, you can't eliminate it, you can't offload it, make it lean. Make it as efficient as possible. Take out the waste from the process as much as you can. So you squeeze everything you can out of your constraint. With C, you squeeze it all out and you get C from 10 to 15 without adding any more money. No new initiatives or IT or resources, you just exploit it. Then we call this subordinate everything else to C. Subordinate, I know, is a hard word. It sounds weird. But if C can only do 15, then don't have the rest of the system doing 20 and 30. Because that's a waste of your time and money. And again, it almost creates more problems because you get inventory problems and backlog and a lot of other issues that happen. So align everything else with what your constraint can do. If you're a child welfare worker, and that child welfare worker can really only produce or work with or help support, I'm just making up a number, 8 families a day, then let's not have the legislature launch 50 new initiatives so that they're supposed to do 20 new things and they can only do 8. Doesn't make any sense. So align the rest of your system with what your constraint can actually do. Once you've done all that, then you talk about, then, only then, do you talk about elevating or putting more money or resources into the entire system to elevate. So if C went from 10 to 15, you've lined the rest of your system up, and we're as effective as we can be. Then you say, oh, I need more money, and you get C to go from 15 to 20. Then you elevate your system through IT or money. What do you think government normally does, though? If they feel like they are at full capacity. They first go and say, I need more money. And our answer is, if you've gone through these first steps, then we'll talk about it. If you haven't gone through those first steps, we're not interested. So that's our approach we'll be taking in this new Office of Management and the Budget. The governor just set this up. I've been on this job for 3 months. So this will become penetrated more and more in our systems. So that's really kind of high-level introduction to it. It's called Theory of Constraints. It was really developed by Dr. Ellie Goldratt. It was for the private sector. We've taken it, changed some of it, adapted it, and released, are working on how does this apply to government. So that's the really the big essence of it. Let's go to the next slide. Next one should be the interference mm-hmm. diagram. Mm-hmm. Really easy way just to eliminate waste. You ask somebody, what's your blue light? What's the thing you should be doing? You put it in the middle. Make a circle, everything around it. What prevents you from doing that? What activities, meetings? So you talk to an eligibility worker and we say, what prevents you from making a determination? They can give you a lot of stuff. You want to get a lot of stuff that's bad, you talk to a worker and say, what prevents you from doing your job? They'll give you a list of things. You just list those around and you start tackling them. Go after them with, again, eliminate, offload, lean it. What are those things around that circle you can just eliminate? What can you offload? What can you lean? Those are really critical things to go through. And it's not just for work. It's for our lives. I mean, how many of us have goals in our lives, things we're trying to achieve? And we get stuck and we don't accomplish it. It's typically because we're in a conflict. I'll talk about that in a second. Or we're doing things we shouldn't be doing and we're not doing things we should be doing. So we want to go through kind of a systematic process to answer those questions. What should we be doing that we're not? What aren't we, you know, what are the things that we're doing that we shouldn't be? And let's really align our work and our time and our resources to line up with that. We get a lot of leverage. This is a really easy tool that you can just sit down with somebody, work them through that, and give you a lot of ideas out of the gates to start moving on it. Next thing is called a cloud. Is that mm-hmm. up there? Mm-hmm. So there are always what we call inherent conflicts in developing a system or public policy. Always. So the conflict is, for example, we should centralize everything, we should decentralize everything. The top managers should make all the decisions, it should be bottom-up decisions. I should change, I should not change. I should get a new IT system, I should keep my legacy system. There's these inherent conflicts in systems design. And as you start to build it, if you don't have a rigorous way to actually break those conflicts, people get stuck and they just start never making progress. They just talk about the tactics back and forth. I wish I had more time on this, but just there are tools that you can take a conflict, and we call this a cloud. It's actually called an evaporating cloud because if you work it, it evaporates. So the conflict that you're in evaporates. And it's just a really rigorous way to say, what am I trying to accomplish? What need am I trying to address? And then what are the assumptions driving that? If you work this process, you can actually find some of the assumptions that are driving your ideas and your decisions. And if you tackle the assumption, you can normally, what we call, break it and find new solutions. So I'm just exposing this to you today. Maybe I'll give some more information to Dr. Chambliss because he could walk you through this. And if we get done with this first hour, I can actually walk you guys through a specific cloud. But it's a really helpful tool because when you're in the middle of a system and you say, we need to provide more compensation to our unemployment insurance recipients. We need to extend their benefits. Inherent cloud, we need to extend their benefits, or no, we can extend their benefits because there's not enough money in the trust fund to pay for that. That becomes an inherent conflict. On one hand, you're trying to make sure people have money so that they don't lose their homes. On the other hand, you don't want to increase taxes for employers because there's no more money in the trust fund, so the only way to pay for the benefits is to increase taxes to employers. What do you do? It's an inherent conflict. People get stuck. What you'll find is that there's ways to address both of those needs if you start looking at the assumptions, and then you can fix the problem. But we'll move on. It's a great tool, and at some point maybe, I don't know, Dr. Chambliss, I'll give you some information on it. So that's a lot of stuff around thinking tools. I wish I could go more into it, but bottom line is before you start launching initiatives or tactics or strategies or any of your stuff, think about your system, understand it, know your constraint, where to focus, what's your root cause. Look at your inherent conflicts in your system and start trying to challenge those before you start just designing a system. So those are really important things to start with. And again, there's a lot of work done by Dr. Ellie Goldratt, and it's not for government, but the tools and the principles I think are very relevant to anything. So you can check him out some more. Next piece of this is S, set your targets. U, use thinking tool. C, create your strategy. Oh my goodness. We had to do, through the Department of Labor, a strategic planning process, and the federal government required states to provide a plan. So, first of all, the plans normally don't have the first two elements of using good logic or having targets or measures. Do you want to know how long our plan was in the state of Utah that we were required to submit our strategic plan? Just guess how long you think it was. Come on. It's month, huh?
A week.
Well, how long, how many pages it was?
Oh, 100 pages.
Yeah.
100.
Yeah, close, 125. How many people do you think are actually going to read a 125-page plan? Heck, I'm not. I didn't even read the plan. I had staff put it together. Yep, signed it. I mean, you scan it, and it goes to the feds. Nobody uses it. Nobody plans with it. So it's just ridiculous. And this happens all over government. You'll just see hundreds of pages and hundreds of pages of state plans, strategic plans, assurance plans. It goes on and on. Nobody uses them. You do have to have a strategy, though. You can't just start willy-nilly doing stuff. Once you understand your constraint, what you need to focus on, you need to understand what's the biggest gap from getting you from where you are today and where you want to go and where you need to focus your time. You're just asking about a gap. And normally you want to, in my world, I want to focus on 2 to 4 things that are really critical. But if I did those 2 or 4 things, that's going to help me exploit my constraint. It's going to help me deal with my root cause analysis, my root cause, you know, 2 to 4 things. And if I do those things really, really, really well, I'll start to move the needle in those targets I had set earlier on. So we do a couple things to make this happen. The first thing we do is called a throughput operating strategy. A throughput operating strategy is a one-page document, one page, that says, what does good look like for our organization? So that you could take it to a legislator, to a worker, and say, this is what good looks like. And it's important because it's not just about, I speak with my hands, so I'm putting my hand on. It's not just about looking at a lot of narrative. It's about understanding, how do you take something and move it through a system? Is this the DWS TOS, Lori?
It is now.
Is this it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Workforce services, we had over 100 different programs, everything from housing, refugee relocation, Medicaid, CHIP, blah, 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 blah. The question is, how do you take 100-plus different programs, a $2 billion budget, and make sense of it? So we had to say, what's our goal? Well, our goal, if you could see at the very end, is to get people jobs. And that wasn't clear. We had Medicaid and all these other things working as if they were separate programs, just doing a little eligibility piece. What we started to say is, hey, no, no, no. We have a whole throughput. Our goal is to move people from unemployment insurance, Medicaid, food stamps, to get them a quick, timely benefit that's not very expensive but accurate and gets them what they need in a timely manner, and move them into our workforce system, because workforce used to act totally in isolation from eligibility. But all these people who were unemployed and workforce was not even paying attention to them. That's the group we need to serve, people who are unemployed. So let's move them into our workforce system. Get them a job. Get them prepared. Connect them with employers. If they need training, we connect them with training. Then we take them from there to our connection activities and we help them move through the system. It's really simple. A throughput operating strategy says a couple things. One, what does good look like? So if we do these things well, we'll be successful. We're not interested in just having a Medicaid program. We're interested in making a timely, accurate decision. We're not just interested in administering a really good Workforce Investment Act program. We're interested in doing good job preparation services. So we try to get rid of all the programs and the names, because those can just force you to think in silos. We have to think in dependencies. What would we need to do in sequence to get people from eligibility into a job? And that becomes our throughput, because you're moving people through a system to their goal. That becomes what we focus on. And it starts breaking down the silos and gets people to think a little outside of their world, but what the entire system's trying to do. It shows us our constraint, the constraints in red. That's our weakest link. For here, it's understanding the workforce needs of employers. If we know what employers need or want and what the trends are and what jobs are open, we can get people to work. And it also tells us what our measurement systems will look like. So it's a really simple tool. There's more thinking behind how you get this developed, but it becomes a one pager that everyone can start saying, "This is what we do. This is our game plan." If you're playing football, you at least I use these football analogies as if I play football. I don't even watch football, but I know about it. But if you're playing football, you'd at least have a game plan. You wouldn't just have people out there running around. You'd at least have a game plan. This is the game plan. So we're never going to be perfect on this, but at least we know what we're trying to achieve. So the next thing you do is, all right, here's our throughput operating strategy. This is our real goal. But there's some tactics, some real specific things we need to do to make that happen. We build what's called a strategy and tactics tree. Strategy and tactics tree is, again, a way to communicate what we're trying to achieve. It's normally in a few pages, and it's built off dependencies. Rather than just having a whole bunch of narrative, we start with the goal on top. We then go down. What are the couple of things we need to do? Our strategies are our levers, 2 to 4 things that will help us achieve that goal. And then what are the tactics underneath that? And it just branches down. And what this does is it helps you understand dependencies. What do I need to do first? Starts on the left, and it moves you down. And then what level of the organization needs to do it? So if you're at the top, that tends to be your top level of management. As you go down from there, that becomes the next level of management. And as you build this strategy and tactics tree, it becomes a very great way for every level, clear down to the frontline worker, to understand what he or she should be doing. And it also sets up cause and effect relationships and dependencies and sequence. So I love it. It's a fantastic way to capture a lot of stuff that's going on and making sure what we do call strategy containment. The hardest thing in government is to contain everyone's ideas, to keep them focused on the goal, to say no to the things that are so-so and say yes to the things that are most critical. This does it because it says if you're 3 levels down in the organization, this is what I should be doing. Here's the tactic I should be focusing on. And I'm doing this because it will help my manager accomplish this, which will help the system achieve its goal. So it really helps penetrate through all levels of the organization what needs to happen. So you set up your strategy. The strategy really answers, what am I trying to, how am I going to get this all done? I've got the goal. How am I going to get this all done now? Okay. Once we do our strategy, then we start about, am I throwing so much at you guys? You guys can just come hang out with me for a few hours one day at work. It'll be lots of fun. Then we start creating our organization. Now, what's funny about you'll get new people at a job, and the first thing they want to start doing is what? Mucking around with the organization. Moving, what do they call the boxes on the org chart and redesigning all that. That stuff is easy to do, and you do it after you understand what your goal is, after you understand your root cause, after you understand your strategy. Then you start thinking about making organizational changes. Why do you think that's important? Why do we want to make organizational changes after we've done that other work? And I'm not giving you the answer. We'll just sit here all day until somebody answers. Why do you think?
There's a reason why the organization is established the way it is, and you need to understand what it is before you can decide if the change you're selecting is good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The organization is simply aligning what people do and who they report to. And if you don't understand what they're supposed to be doing through your strategy and root cause, then you can't have a good organization design. So the other piece is when you have a lot of clarity on what people should do, you tend to need less management layers because there's a lot of clarity in your organization. You can focus on spans of control. You can focus on admin ratios to operational costs. You can focus on who reports to whom and all that other stuff that's fun and great and nice and it's the easy stuff. But you only do that once you know what you're going to organize around. If I'm in this new office, Governor's Office of Management and Budget, and we're just looking at our organization, if I don't know what we're trying to accomplish with operational excellence or business process improvements or how the budget lines up with operations, I can't match people's skill set with the job. And if I can't match their skill set with the job, then I can't make a good organizational design. It's ridiculous. So we're not even talking in our office organizational design until we finish all this prep work. So that's really critical. We won't spend a lot of time on that, but just know, don't do that until you get this other work done. Then you move from SUCCE, engage your staff. So you've done all this work, you know your strategy, you know your tactics. you want to communicate this to your staff. You want them to fully understand your throughput operating strategy and your strategy and tactics tree, what's their role in making all this happen. You want to train them in the basics of constraints management and root cause and interference diagrams and all the good thinking, because they need to be empowered to make decisions. The people on the ground know so much more than we often do at the higher levels. They need to have the tools and the resources to make good decisions. We need to align their performance plans with the goals. So in workforce services, we didn't want it to be all about processing tasks, which is what their performance plans used to look like. We wanted to move them to making determinations. So we changed their performance plans. They have to make quality standards and so many determinations. We also then do pay for performance. If you are successful and if you can exceed, become a high performer, you can get more money, because it saves us money and will help you become more successful. But you can only launch those kind of compensation initiatives when you understand what you want your staff to achieve. So that's really important. But this other chart we call the well chart. And we call it the well chart because when we designed it, is that there?
Yeah. Yes.
It's up there? Mm-hmm. Okay. When I felt it, it looked like a well. Does that look like a well to you at all? Kind of. You don't have to humor me. But it felt like it. We do a lot of glue gunning at the office. She brings a glue gun, and that's how I figure out what. You really want to understand what your staff, your employees can do. Because what you'll find in this well chart, standard deviation, we had people at both ends that were doing amazing work. So on the high end, we had a small percentage that were doing 400% the work that people on the low end were doing. Just kicking it out of the park. It wasn't a lot of them, but there were a few of them that were just kicking it out of the park. What does that tell me as a director about my system when I see a percentage of people just doing amazing work? What does that tell me? I'll tell you what it told me. I didn't need a lot of new IT, big IT solutions. I didn't need a lot of more money. I didn't need a lot more staff. What I needed to do is help the middle people, the average people, even 10 or 20% of those, move up and become like the high performers. So in government, we say, we don't have any, we need more money. We're broke. We need more money. Understand what your staff can do. First, you understand your goal, what you want them to do. Once you're clear on what you want them to do and they're doing that, notice how they're performing. Because what do you think would happen if we could move 20% of our average performers into the high performance zone? Think how much more capacity we'd have in our system. How many more determinations we make, how many more whatever could happen, how many kids could be helped for no more cost, just by helping these be successful. So what we do in this is part of staff engagement is training. Now, you could just train the whole world, but where you want to do is focus where you're going to get the biggest bang for your buck. So high performers can help, you know, peer-to-peer, help them train their folks that are not doing so well. You go in and you look at these high performers and you go, what are you doing? What's your trick? These guys have tricks. They know more stuff than we do at management. They're doing amazing things. Help teach us and the rest of the staff of what they're doing to be so successful. So that really helped us focus our targeting efforts. This chart, we don't have the latest. Here we don't have it. It's there. It's actually moved. There's been this portion of average performers that have moved forward in the system that now are doing more work. They can get paid for performance. They can get paid more for doing more work because it saves us money and it helps them out, and they get more money. Everyone's happy moving forward. No big deal. Super easy. No new high-tech costs. Understand your workforce. This seems simple. It doesn't happen enough. It just doesn't simply happen enough in government. Final thing is this idea of stay focused. If you're holding a bottle of Coke, which I actually like Pepsi.
Chris,
so
synchronize.
Oh, synchronize. Oh, I missed the most critical one. Who has? Do you guys have paper and pens? Or are you all using iPads? You're all using, okay, paper and pens. We're going to do a game. You guys want to do a fun game? Yes! Be excited. It's super fun. So I'm your boss, and I've come to you, and I'm giving you three projects all at the same time. Okay? Three projects. And I want you to start. Lori, do you have your timer?
I do on my phone.
Will you grab that?
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to, will you read it out every 20 seconds too?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do three projects. The first project is you write A through Z. Second project is you write 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, all the way down. And the third project is you write circle, square, triangle, circle, square, triangle, circle. Repeat that. Do you hear that? Circle, square, triangle? Because you're going to get graded on this. Circle, square, triangle. Seems pretty easy. But you're going to do all of these projects at the same time. So I want you to write A, 1, circle. B, 2, square. Does that make sense? Yes? No? No? No. So instead of doing one project at a time, writing A, B, C, D, 1, 2 to 26, circle, square, triangle, because that would make sense and be easy, we're going to do how government works, and we're going to launch all the projects on you at the same time and expect you to do what we call bad multitasking. I want you to do all the projects. So start with project run and write A, then you stop and start working on the next project. You write 2, then you stop there, work on the third project, do circle. How many of us in our lives start one project, start, and then start the next project? You ever do that? It's insanity. You'll see it in a second. So I want you to just do that. You're all smart. You guys are smarter than me. You're here. I did special ed. So, I mean, seriously, you guys are way more prepared than me. You're going to be graded on this. Your bonus depends on this. Your performance plan is based on this. So we're going to time you. And as you get done, we'll give you 2 minutes. We'll see how many can get done. And Lori, every 15, 20 minutes, 20 minutes, that'd be torture. 20 seconds, we'll kind of read out to you where we're at. And as you get done, raise your hand, and let's see how frustrated you are. Okay, ready, set, go. Get going, guys. Work harder. If you just work harder, you get it done. You got 2 minutes. Just work harder.
Sounds like an exam question.
30 seconds.
If you don't get this done, you're going to have to do overtime. So you have to work. You got a minute 15 left, guys.
By the way, we have 14 minutes remaining.
Okay, good. We'll get through it. I've got one more thing after this, and we'll be done. What do they got?
60 seconds.
60 seconds, and you're not done yet. Seriously, people. Work harder. We're going to give them only 20 more seconds. What are they at, Lori?
15.
All right, we're going to just stop right there because you guys are slackers. Minute 15, you can't get these two projects. I mean, seriously. Now we're going to try it this new way. The new way. This is called the logical way, but the way we don't do our lives. We're going to, by the way, anyone get done? Were you frustrated? Super frustrated. Try it as a blind person. My gosh, I can't even remember what I just wrote. It's a nightmare. So I'm horrible at this game. Now, we're going to try it the simple way. You just do one project at a time. Write 1, A through Z, 1 through 26, circle, square, triangle a few times. And when you're done, raise your hand. We're going to start. Mark, get set, go. I know this is getting recorded, so I'm thinking the people on the radio, what are they going to do? I could sing Christmas carols for them.
15 seconds.
15 seconds. I bet we're getting good progress now. Anyone done with project one?
30 seconds.
Anyone done with project two? Oh, my goodness, 30 seconds when you have two projects done. Just do circle, square, triangle a few times. And if you're done, raise your hand.
45 seconds.
45 seconds. Do we have people done?
Mm-hmm.
All right. About do you five. Guys get the point? What's the point in that?
I'm hurrying.
I'm hurrying. But what else is the point?
Stay focused.
Prioritize. Bad multitasking in our own personal lives and at work are horrible. This next step is synchronize your policies and your projects. we have a lot of projects going on in government, IT projects, redesign projects, strategy, a lot of projects. And we can take these and go to somebody and just say, here's five projects. Do them all at once and start now. What we want to do in this area is really get solid project management systems put up so the decisions we make, one, align with our goals. If somebody's going to make a policy decision, they need to know that it's going to support the goal. Unemployment insurance, is that going to help somebody get a job or prevent them from getting a job when you write that policy? They need to know that. The second piece is project management. One is, how many projects do you launch into your system at a time? We call it choke and release. You choke projects and you release them when the system has capacity to actually deal with them, and you want to do one or two at a time. We call it critical chain management. There's the other stuff we call it agile management. But it's a really great thing of how do you prevent this bad multitasking from happening in your organization. Now, look at that example we just did. We did an hour and 15 minutes. No one got their projects done. Hour and 15. A minute and 15. No one got their projects done. Before we did 45, many of you had your projects done. Do you think the quality was better? Yeah, get better quality the second time. So we really want to, in our systems, start thinking about solid project management practices. This is just one little example to give you guys a sense of it. But it really can, if you can just have the same amount of staff you already have, but use their time better through good project management, you can get significantly more work done with better quality with the same resources or less. So again, it's going into government and saying there's hidden capacity there to do more at a better job if we think through it. So I think it is at home. Like I was talking to my husband the other day. It's like at home, I would never at the same time say I'm going to mow my lawn, make cookies, paint a room in my house and put up my Christmas tree all at the same time. I just wouldn't do that. But I get to work, and somehow I think that that's a reasonable thing. I don't know. All right, so that's the last thing is stay focused, especially for management. If you take a bottle of not Coke but Pepsi, where's the bottleneck? Top. The bottleneck's always usually at the top. We had two slides that we didn't bring today, but it's so important for managers to stay focused. I feel it's one of the most difficult things for me. I feel pulled in many directions. Advocates need things. I feel, you know, I need to support staff and get that lined up, and I need to help, you know, obviously the governor, I need to support him and his goals. I've got my own personal projects I'm trying to take on. I feel very pulled in many directions, like probably many of you do in your lives. But when we go back to the thing of bad multitasking, focusing on C versus all the other pieces, management has to stay focused. Now, there is an example. I wish I could explain it. How much time do I have, Dr. Chambliss? Four minutes.
4 minutes.
4 minutes. And then after, I'll answer some questions. But if you're a manager and you have four people under you and they each have 40 hours, so you're managing 160 hours worth of time, but you send them too many projects at a time or you're not available, if you've given them projects and they need your support and time to say yes or no or to make decisions or remove roadblocks, and you don't align your own schedule to make sure you're available for them, what can typically happen is that they have to stop working on their projects until they can get your clearance. And then once they get their clearance, they can start working on them again. In some examples we put up there, 30% of their time in a week, you have an individual, you know, 30% of 40 hours is not much, is actually used on the priority projects because they're waiting for you. And when they can't get the decision, they start working on other things that aren't as important. So if you've got 160 hours and you're only allowing them to use 30% of their time and they each have four reports and each of their time is only being maximized 30%, you can see the trickle-down effect. Hundreds to thousands of hours of people's times are not being spent on the priority projects because we as managers aren't clearing roadblocks or giving decision points for them, and we're stopping the whole system from moving forward. So staying focused is so important as a manager, having the right schedule, making sure you have dashboards that you're monitoring the progress, that you recognize performance, acknowledge good performance, and that your time and your schedule aligns with the priorities you've set for your staff so that we as managers are available in the process, or we become a big bottleneck. Management attention and focus is often the biggest constraint in an organization. If we can't get our act together, we create dysfunction through the entire system. So, success framework, in conclusion, is just a really great roadmap to accelerate substantial gains in government. And there's a lot more detail to this, but it's exciting to see that if in public policy you take a bold idea, a bold goal, that there are actual ways to make that a reality. And you can do it in a way that's very cost-effective for the taxpayer and gives better value for the customer receiving the service from government. And I just really appreciate the opportunity to be here with you guys. You guys are young, probably ambitious, aggressive people who want to make a difference in this world, and we need people like you to go out and do it and to do it in a responsible way that really protects the very scarce resources we have in this country. All right, I'm open, I guess, after for questions. Thanks.
That's the conclusion of today's Sinclair Forum, so let's give Chris and Cox a round of applause.